Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah.
You just listened to the program Hadith of the Day on Iran Radio with Sheikh Danish.
Allahumma salli ala Muhammadin wa ali Muhammad. Allahumma salli ala Muhammadin wa ali Muhammad. Allahumma salli ala Muhammadin wa ali Muhammad.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. This is the Heart of Life Pounding. IRIB English Radio.
Salam to all tuning in. This is Iran Radio, broadcasting from the beating heart of Tehran. I'm here to welcome you into a world of conversation, culture, and insight. Iran Radio presents some interesting facts about the Holy Quran. The word Bismillah appears 114 times in the Quran. It occurs twice in chapter An-Naml, whereas chapter Tawbah is the only surah which does not begin with Bismillah. Quran believes in life after death, and the Quran teaches us that besides having a body, a human being also has a spirit, a soul. And when a person dies, the physical body vanishes, while the soul remains. Coming up now, another captivating segment of radio productions. Then it's time for Youth Station, a program created for young minds, navigating modern life through an Islamic lens. Topics include faith, friendships, personal style, prayer, and finding a shared identity in today's world. Next, don't miss Spotlight. So stick around, there's more to come.
Worst enemy of the human being. It makes us not being able to see the beautiful things that are surrounding us. It makes us not realizing the good things that are happening in our lives. While we continue our sometimes not exciting and so-called modern life, some people come to remind us of the treasures we have and remove the dust of oblivion of the jewels that we keep in the basement of our houses. Lena is a German girl who recently published a book called Behind the Closed Curtains, which reminds us that it is possible to dust off our traditional home elements, remodel them, and give them a modern look, and create a daring, bold, and lively interior design. What Lena has recorded in her book is only a sample of the historical background of using decorations in Iranian interior design and architecture, which is rooted in combination of Iranian culture, religion, and art. And it has evolved as time passes by. As a matter of fact, Iranian houses were a place for development of spirit and physical calmness. There is one thing in common between us and Lena. We both use this camera to record interesting events and life stories. Lena and her team traveled all over Iran and took their camera behind the closed curtains of Iranian houses. They shot photos and recorded lifestyles, decorations, and designs. that are somehow modern, but have roots in our history. Something that was not possible a couple of hundred years ago, but Lena wants to make sure she produces something that can be used as a reference for future generations. Something that shows where and how some Iranians live in the 21st century.
I was a student of Middle Eastern Studies politics back in Germany, and was learning some Farsi, the Farsi of the books. And I wanted to learn the proper Farsi of the streets and really get to know the country itself. Traveling in Iran, I understood that, okay, there is something in Iran we don't have that way so much. We also have it in Europe, but not in that way, which is handicrafts. So what I understood is like, okay, handicrafts, that's something everyone can relate to because it is interior design, it is decoration. Everyone has a house you have to decorate. So that's where I started. I thought, okay, also in Iran, there will be people who decorate their house and decorate them in a nice way, even if they're probably not interior designers.
What makes Iranian decorative elements more special is that they're timeless. You always find some shining aspects in them, something to fall in love with.
I think it's really cool when you're mixing something from old and bringing it into the modernity. So this is, for example, what Murtaza did here with these henna stones, which are traditionally used to paint the, or you place the feet on it the night before you're getting married, and then you got the henna painted on the feet. So this was the original use, but what Murtaza did, he copied them and use them as basically the feet for a coffee table. It is used outside of the religious context. It's decoration. And I think it is really a beautiful and impressive piece, especially, of course, with all the feathers in this pink, fleshy color, contrasting to the white of the house. In Iranian culture, I mean, there is the flower as a topic is really important. So what we see here is like a lale, actually it's a light, which means also in Persian the flower. And here I think it's really nice the shape you find them throughout Iran. These either candles or nowadays also they work with electricity. But it's a soft shape, so again, it's a curve like in Iranian architecture you find a lot.
Amir Hossein is an Iranian artist inspired by his roots. What is more felt at his house is a daring innovation that definitely comes from a character full of taste and art. What he does is to introduce another usage for the elements of Persian architecture and art, and thus let us see beyond the ordinary and normal elements of our life. A center yard with a pond in the middle, which is surrounded by rooms with different usages during different seasons of the year. At the first glance, you think this is a typical Iranian traditional house. But for sure, it is nothing like my grandparents' house. From what I remember, many decorative and architectural elements are the same, but they're being used very differently. And this creativity is certainly part of the beauty of this house. Decorating your house is definitely not a piece of cake, especially when you're looking for some very unique items that are infused with Persian culture and our traditions. But But remember that there's an artist inside of every one of us. An artist that knows what is beautiful and what is not. An artist that knows how to put things together. But we don't necessarily have the creativity to make these decorative items. And for that reason, people in places like here made our lives easy. You just need to come here and see all these beautiful items. Pick what you love. Make sure that it goes good with your other stuff. And make sure that it fits your personality. Stores like this are the results of a recently started movement by some young Iranians who renovate old houses and decorate them with antique-like and traditional decorative items. I'm very inspired by all these amazing stuff and looking forward to use them to decorate my own house sometime soon.
I should say this is the happiest day of my life because I published a book on interior design in Iran. And this is the final day, the book presentation. I feel super happy. I am super exhausted too, because it has been hard work. I've gone through a lot of ups and downs in the last 8 months, but I feel proud to now say, okay, I published a book, this is the book, and I'm a writer. And I've done something for Iran, a country I really love, and I started with the purpose to show a different Iran to the world, and I think I achieved it.
And Iran is a mysterious land. Every corner of it and every aspect of it is a book with thousands of pages, with beautiful images and amazing stories. Shahriyar Azimi for Iran.
Try to follow the signs, that's how I live my life. Cause when I lead it, my heart, it all goes wrong. My journey has been on time, but only for a short while. The road that I've been on is far too long, and the picture's never clear. Right now I'm building bridges, the shortcuts don't.
movement.
Speed.
Live in hope.
Toward the peak.
On Youth Station.
Youth Station. Youth Station.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحیم. السلام علیکم to all of you dear listeners of IRIB English Radio. Welcome to another episode of Youth Station. This is Nahid having the honor of being with you. And here with me, I have the honor of being with my very dear brother,
Muhammad. And assalamu alaikum to everyone listening to us.
Wa alaikum assalam. So, how's life going with your brother?
Great. With my parents, can't be any better.
Oh.
I'm not living with them, but like I have a very good relationship with them, alhamdulillah.
Oh, nice. Yeah. Talking about parents, I just remembered that coming here today made me a bit even feel worse. because there was this problem with my car, and then I asked my dad to fix it, and I can't believe why he could make this mistake. He just told me to buy something, then we bought it, and then we wanted to fix it, and the car was even worse than before, so I had a kind of argument with him.
That's basically when you realize that your dad is no longer the superhero that you were always imagining.
I don't want to. He has to be one.
Well, you see, the parents, I believe that while we grow up in our different stages in life, I feel that we perceive our parents differently. When we were kids, we saw our parents as superheroes. And they were, to be honest,
yeah.
You know, staying awake in the nights when we were sick.
They were the main characters of our story.
We saw no one except them.
Right.
Staying awake, whenever we feel sick, parents. Whenever we fall down, parents. Whenever we feel an injury, parents. Whenever someone hurts us, parents. Everything was our parents. And so we felt that, okay, there is no one existent for us except for our parents. And I think that stage is a very important stage. And that's why many families that I know, at least, who have had bad experiences with their parents in their early childhood, really feel that their parents are that important. They never really feel that their parents are really superheroes, to be honest.
So who's right? I mean, me with this mindset that my parents should be the know-it-all, they should always be there. Is this concept right? Or the ones that feel like they have to be independent or they shouldn't rely on their parents?
I feel when you're growing and you're maturing and your mindset is developing, your concept of your parents being infallible and superheroes kind of slowly fades away and it becomes natural. Now, where I believe I personally have also made mistakes is that after maturing, you still expect superhero things from them as opposed to accepting them as they are.
Yeah,
not really.
Because they are growing up with me as well.
Not only are they growing up, they're interactions with you changes based on your maturity. Like,
right.
Like after 7, 8, maybe even 9, when they see that you've grown up, they're not only serving you, they're not only your servants, and you're not the king anymore, they're expecting things from you. They're expecting that you also live up to some of your responsibilities, do some home some chores for the home. And then you realize, up until now, I was the king. I was the queen, if it's a sister, then I was looking after, I was being looked after, I was spoon fed. Why is it now that I have to? Now this kind of slowly fades away, and then you reach the age of further maturity, maybe 12, 13, at least for myself, that's how it was. I realized, no, my parents are really not who I expected them to be as superheroes. They make mistakes as well. They become angry as well. They're not always as tolerant as, you know, when the kids are kids. After becoming a parent, that's when you realize this. When kids are kids, you're really tolerant as a parent.
Yeah, but with the case that you explained, I feel there is a need for maturity in children to realize it.
Yeah.
I mean, as a teacher, I'm in touch with lots of teenagers and kids and adults. I mean, I see the process that they grow up.
Exactly.
Like, they come to our classes when they are 7 or 8, and after a few years, we see them, wow, of that person is 12 now.
Exactly.
And I see this change in them. And not all of them have this maturity, have this, let's say not even maturity, this understanding that their expectations should be balanced in a way that parents can realize and understand it. These days, I see many of these new generation kids and teenagers having struggles with their parents just over the expectations. I mean, they grow up, so they expect their parents to be even more supportive.
Exactly, yeah. But you see, the thing is, when you grow up and you see that support fading away, now, what makes things really worse, and alhamdulillah, I personally am not... I'm not faced with this because my parents are very cohesive. My father and mother, they're very cohesive. May Allah protect them and lengthen their life. They try to avoid their personal conflicts encroaching into our lives. And that is extremely important.
Yeah.
And it really develops that healthy nature in the family. But I've seen many of my friends, and probably I can say most of my friends, they have... parents who are conflicting each other. Now, this makes things worse because parents, when they see kids or kids, when they're small, they kind of somehow get together.
Right.
Even if one is wrong, the other is right.
At least they don't show it.
Exactly. But then the kids is now mature and so on. Then the eyes of the kids are now open. Then he realizes, oh, my father and mother, they fight. They have so many conflicts. Now, this makes things extremely difficult for kids as youths who are growing up. And I myself, although I haven't faced much of these issues, but when I see others going through, I really become grateful. And these are things that we should tackle as youths. We should not be, okay, they're bad and that's it. No. Are you good?
Yeah, that's the thing that I was thinking about right now, that there are two sides, the side of the parents and the side of the kids, the kids of the family, be it mature or be it the young children of the family. There are two sides, two perspectives, so there is no one person to be blamed, not the parents, neither the kids. But what is the root that will cause all this dilemma, all these problematic situations once the kids grow up and have their expectations? Let's go for a short break and then we're going to explain it.
This is IRIB English Radio. You are listening to Youth Station.
All right, so you're listening to the Youth Station, and welcome back to this episode. We're talking about parents and expecting things from parents, and what happens when our parents are not based on our expectations. They're no longer the superhero that we expected them to be when we were small. You were explaining, Sister Nahid, you were telling us about what happens in situations of dilemma.
You know, sometimes I felt the root for these kinds of problems as in the parents' behavior. I know in my close relatives, a child who is 7 years old, and since he was like 4 or 3 years old, the parents started to support him with whatever, I mean, literally whatever he needed.
He was the king, basically.
Yeah, and things that were not even appropriate for him. Like, he was 6 years old, and he wanted a laptop, so the parents bought it.
Mm-hmm.
Then he grew up.
Without any parental controls, of course.
Yeah, and I was just like telling them that this is not suitable for his age. If he goes for games that are not suitable,
mm-hmm.
I don't know, many scary things that are not suitable for his age, and he sees them and encounters, what if it causes terrors in him? Then they said, no, he wants it, and we have to be supportive. Because in our own childhood, we didn't have these kinds of opportunities.
They misunderstood the supportive part
of
the
parenting.
Exactly,
so we have to support him. And now he's 7 years old, he has the laptop, he has his own phone.
All the gadgets he can think of.
Anything that he needs. And once we ask him, do you like school? Do you like to study? Everything in life looks meaningless to him.
Oh, wow.
He says, okay, why should I go to school? I don't need to.
I think that really brings up the point of generational gap.
Right.
Especially after 20s and the bloom of internet and everything, and the gadgets and the technology, the parents of... Gen Zs, as we would call it, they are less technology literate. They do not know they've seen the benefits of technology. They've seen how much a person who can use technology properly, can improve in his life, and maybe
or
excel. But the opposite is not really much, at least in the case of what you mentioned about, you know, that six-year-old child, they haven't seen the opposite as much. So they think that, okay, let me give the laptop, and they probably would be able to look after it. And as a youth, let me be very frank. I also had exactly the same wishes and you know, all sorts of demands from my parents. I need a laptop. I need...
All of us did.
Yeah, we used to use a shared laptop, but then I personally wanted one for myself. I need a phone, and phone is something that my father had a red line with. And I really thank him for that, because I've seen many people of my own friends, my own classmates, my own best friends, my own, you know, colleagues who have, you know, grown up with me from the high school age onwards. Whoever had a phone never really was successful, not in their classes, not in their, you know, lessons and subjects, but also in their life.
Yeah, and the troubles they faced.
Exactly. And what happens is that this very liberal form of communication, anyone can now contact anyone. Without any controls, without... Now, this destroyed the class, basically, this bloom of technology. Though there were a lot of benefits, I do understand that, and I alhamdulillah, I was able to reap a lot of them. But then we need to appreciate the harms that technology brings in our lives. And parents need to understand this as well, just as the youths. Now, what happens when the parents don't realize? What is the responsibility of us as youths? Should we demand and get as much as we can from the parents?
Well, with your children, we cannot officially. I mean, we normally enjoy new things. So if I was 7 years old, 8 years old, and my parents would have given me something big like a laptop or a phone, I would have been so excited and happy about it. So I think there is a kind of time limitation for us as well.
Would you do that yourself? Would you put time limitations for yourself if your parents didn't do that?
Yes.
Now, let's be honest.
Yeah.
Would you do that?
Yeah, even thinking as... having my own child, I would think like there is the need for this limitation. I mean, for a mobile phone, for example, I had this time limitation of 14 years old at that time. And before that, I used to ask them to, I want the phone, and everybody around me is having this phone.
I mean, I've seen adults now who have grown up, who are parents, who are probably in their 30s and 40s. Once they go into Instagram or any TikTok, they can't control it. And it becomes a very big problem in the family. Now, let alone youths. Do you think it's a danger for us as youths that we should avoid demanding? Or should we really go towards that route of demanding and still controlling ourselves?
I think there's a need for education. What is missed here...
For the parents or the youths?
Both. Mm-hmm. Both the parents and the kids, the youth. We need this education. A young person in the society has to know that... she or he has to go for some studying. They have to be knowing the dangers that are threatening them. Mm-hmm. Because even if my parents are educated, well-educated, and they know everything, and then there is some point that they cannot monitor the things that I'm doing, the things that I'm searching about on the internet. So there is this need for my own knowledge and my own acknowledgement of the things that I might see or the way that I have to work with technology. So I think both parties need this education. It's needed for them.
And it's expected from both of them to have their own set of controls. As a parent, control your child. And as a youth, you have a life ahead of you. You are a person different from your parent. You are not equal to your parent. You are different. You're separate. You're completely new existent.
Exactly.
Right? You're not the same person. You're not expected to follow the exact same things that your parents followed, whether it be good or bad. You're supposed to make your own life. So from that lens, being independent from your parent in trying to upbring yourself and putting disciplinary measures for yourself is also extremely important. And I think there's a lot more to discuss with regards to our expectations from our parents.
Yeah, we can talk about it in another episode. And I'm going to mention that still, even talking about this need for education, I'm going to name parents. I mean, the parents are the reasons that kids have to be aware that they have to be educated.
Exactly, exactly. And I think this brings us to the conclusion of this episode. In the interest of time, we will conclude it. And inshallah, in a future episode, we will definitely talk more about our expectations from the parents. And I think... the book is still open, and it will remain open for ages, because parents and children, they will continue to thrive, and they will continue to have problems from generation to generation, and I think discussions are still to be made.
So with the hope to meet you in another episode, wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Wa alaikum salam.
I will tell you, dear youth, that the future belongs to you. By Allah's favor, you, dear youth, will see that day, and you will hand down your sources of pride to the future generations. Greetings be upon you and Allah's mercy and blessings.
And inshallah, we will continue talking about
this. We'll discuss that, inshallah, in the next session. Wassalamu alaikum wa
rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. And don't go away.
We will continue this very essential topic with our great youth.
Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
IRIB English Radio.
Bring us out from Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story.
What is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of international.
The Spotlight.
Hello and welcome to Spotlight. The Hezbollah chief has slammed Israel's repeated ceasefire violations, saying that the regime seeks to lay the groundwork for Lebanon's gradual occupation and push for its Greater Israel project. The remarks come after a UN Security Council delegation met with Lebanese officials in Beirut to discuss the ceasefire and the almost daily Israeli aggressions. Press TV's Mariam Saleh looks into the issue.
Despite heightened U.S. and Israeli pressures on Lebanon, Hezbollah Secretary General Sheikh Naim Qassem says the resistance will not give up its only defensive capability. In a televised speech Friday, he emphasized that Hezbollah has no regard for U.S. and Israeli dictates.
We are cooperating with the government, which has taken the diplomatic route to end the aggression, and we are supporting it in its efforts. The U.S. and Israel have no business in dictating how we manage our internal affairs. Whatever we decide in Lebanon or what we do in Lebanon, whether on the issue of arms or other issues, does not concern them. The only framework which needs to be met in dealing with the Israeli enemy is the ceasefire agreement. We have complied, but Israel has not.
The Hezbollah chief said Israel's aggressions have nothing to do with Hezbollah's weapons. He said the regime seeks to lay the groundwork for the gradual occupation of Lebanon and push for its Greater Israel project. Sheikh Qassem warned that if Lebanon concedes, the U.S.-Israeli conditions will not be limited to the issue of arms. Experts believe that while the U.S. and Israel are jointly working on one agenda, they might differ on the means.
One area where they might disagree.
Well, joining us for tonight's edition of Spotlight, we have political analyst and international coordinator Charlotte Cates joining us from the Lebanese capital, Beirut. And we also have activist and commentator Mick Napier, who's with us from Glasgow, UK. Welcome to the program. Let's start off with Ms. Cates in Beirut. The Hezbollah chief has slammed Israel's repeated ceasefire violations and aggressions against Lebanon. Sheikh Naim Qasim says the attacks have nothing to do with Hezbollah's weapons, and rather the expansionist Israeli regime seeks to lay the groundwork for Lebanon's gradual occupation and to kickstart the so-called Greater Israel Project through the Lebanese front. Please walk us through these key comments coming from Sheikh Naim Qasim.
Well, Sheikh Naim Qasim is, of course, absolutely correct regarding what is currently taking place in Lebanon, the role of the United States and these forces that are attempting to pressure Lebanon, as well as certainly the ongoing Zionist attacks, which are taking place on a daily basis. It's been over a year since November 27th, 2024, since there was a ceasefire signed. Mm-hmm. And the result has been that there is a one-sided ceasefire in Lebanon. And nearly every day, the Zionists are engaging in bombing attacks, attempts to invade Lebanon. The fact is that the Zionist army was not able to seize a meter of land in South Lebanon during their overt and open invasion in 2024. It has only been during the ceasefire that they are able to continue out the same kinds of aggression. And the reason why they were prevented from actually advancing, other than by using their warplanes to sort of rain down destruction mm-hmm. upon the people of Lebanon, is because of the strength, power, and organization of the resistance. It's the resistance that prevented, if it weren't for Hezbollah and the Lebanese resistance, right now the south of Lebanon would be occupied by the Zionists and they would be rushing in to set up settlements. In fact, they were sending in, scholars to go study South Lebanon in order to make plans for settlements, and they were confronted by the resistance. This was during the open war between October and November of 2024. Right now, what we're seeing on a daily basis is there are attacks, very open attacks and assassinations of engineers, of home builders. One of the most frequent targets in South Lebanon are actually bulldozers and construction equipment, because the Zionists are attempting to prevent the people of South Lebanon from rebuilding from the damage that they caused, because they actually do want to settle and occupy the south of Lebanon. And every single one of these so-called U.S. conditions that the U.S. is attempting to impose upon Lebanon serves no other purpose except to weaken Lebanon and attempt to divide it in order to provide this quantitative advantage and qualitative advantage to the Zionist entity in the region.
Mick Napier, the Lebanese president, Joseph Aoun, he met with a delegation from the United Nations Security Council in Beirut. He urged the Security Council to pressure Israel to respect the ceasefire and to withdraw from Lebanon. We know that the UN has done nothing with regards to any of the Israeli violations in Lebanon, and also the daily massacres that we're seeing in Gaza. Both are in so-called ceasefires with the regime. How do you explain this inaction of the international community with the UN at its helm?
I mean, there was a time in the past, quite distant past, when the US and the UN would condemn Israeli aggression against Lebanon. I forget what year it was, when the Israelis attacked Beirut Airport and smashed up, destroyed pretty much the whole Lebanese civilian aircraft fleet. And they were condemned by the UN and I think even by the US. But those days, America simply ignored it. But those days are gone. And now I think, given that America is concerned much more about China than about anything in the Middle East, and for quite some long time has been talking about a pivot to Asia and actually reducing their forces in the area over the long term, I think they have put more eggs in the Israeli basket. And I think they are quite prepared to support Israel in everything it does, because they don't want to have American boots on the ground in the Middle East. So in a sense, the weakening of America in the area has led to them relying much more on the genocidal apartheid state to do the work for them. So Israel can get away with anything. It can get away with the mass genocide. It can get away with attacking Lebanon. It can get away with attacking Syria. And there are some voices in the U.S. at the moment, sorry, in Israel at the moment, who are talking about partitioning Syria, and that Israel will hold on to the ground which it occupied within the last few months. So there is no limit to the appetite of the Israelis for expansion. All that constrains them is their evaluation of the resistance which they will encounter if they try to do something. And they think at the moment, for example, that they can seize a part of Syria, either by insisting on the so-called demilitarization of an area, i.e. no oppositional military force allowed while their military takes over, or the actual seizure of it. They've already insisted that the Golan Heights is a part of Israel. They claim it's a part of Israel. And there's no reason why, if they have the ability, the Israelis will not try to expand
right
across the Middle East. Moshe Dayan talked about an Israeli empire. Golda Meir, Ben-Gurion, they always said the only limit to the Israeli to Israel is the ability to seize and hold ground. So I think that Charlotte's right. Only resistance can inhibit and slow down and prevent this and drive it backwards. But this is at a moment when America will give Israel the green light to do pretty much anything to weaken the states which surround it.
Charlotte Cates, about the greater Israel scheme. Benjamin Netanyahu and many other right-wing ministers have openly talked about this quote-unquote vision of a greater Israel, and they constantly brag about this expansionist project. What does this mean, not just for Palestinians, but for the entire region? And who are the main obstacles to an Israeli occupation spanning across West Asia?
I mean, just to be clear, the Zionist project has never been a project that is limited in time and space. It's always been, I mean, as Mick was describing, there is a tremendous appetite to carry out the project. The terminology that's been used to describe the Zionist project in Palestine has been that they're always trying to take more land and make sure there are fewer Arabs there. So constantly pushing out and engaging in ethnic cleansing, genocide, forced deportation and expulsion of the indigenous local population, and occupying and stealing land in order to settle it, in order to engage in a settler project, in order to exploit it, in order to exploit those who remain as a labor force, essentially, for the profit of the Zionist entity and its imperialist sponsors. And this has been part and parcel of the Zionist project from the beginning. It's not something that's new, and it's something that they've been supported in by Britain, the United States, and other imperialist powers, except to the extent that the U.S., for example, sees any value in maintaining its relationship or maintaining and propping up certain levels of client Arab regimes, Arab reactionary regimes, essentially as, partners to the United States, as states that are willing to host U.S. military bases directly and that engage in a very profitable economic relationship with the United States. So that's been the only kind of holdback, except for, of course, the forces of resistance in the region. And so, you know, despite the horrors, the absolute horrors of the ongoing genocide and the escalated genocide over the past 2 years in Gaza, at no point was the occupation ever able to fully occupy Gaza. Even now, when there have been a few isolated resistance fighters cut off from even the news of a ceasefire, they are still able to fight back in Rafah in the most unimaginable of conditions, cut off without food, without water, without even access to their comrades. And the same is true in Lebanon, the same is true in Iraq, the same is true in Iran, and of course the same is true in Yemen, where the Ansarullah movement, together with the armed forces and people of Yemen, reshaped the economy of the Red Sea and of Bab al-Mandab and of the Zionist ports. It's only the resistance forces that have been providing a strong bulwark against the expansionism of the Zionist state. And the partners in that project, or the people who have the capacity to be partners to the resistance project in the region, are certainly the popular movements around the world that have taken to the streets enforce in order to stand with the Palestinian people against genocide, but also to stand with everyone in the region. This is also a time when some of these complicit and compliant Arab regimes, for example, in Egypt, really should start thinking clearly and recognizing clearly the threat that exists in the region, rather than continuing to play the game of acting on behalf of the U.S. and the Zionist entity.
Mick Napier, what's really mind-boggling here is the sheer hypocrisy in all of this. Let's say if, for example, in a hypothetical situation, Mexico had a greater Mexico plan with officials, Mexican officials, using a poster that had parts of Texas and California and Arizona included on its map. There would be outrage among Western governments.
Well, you see, where you see hypocrisy, I only see consistency. That if you are allied with America and Brussels and the UK and the whole imperium, you can pretty much do what you want. You can invade, you can seize, you can destroy, you can torture, you can take a political opponent and dissolve him in acid, and that will be okay. For Mr. Trump and also for his predecessors. Anything goes. If you're not aligned with the empire, nothing goes. Anything you do, however benign, malign, positive, however humane, however committed to the welfare of your own people, anything you do will be seen as terrorism, as something horrible, or if it can't be attacked, it will be ignored. Look, there is absolute consistency. If you're with America, anything goes. If you're against America, then you'll always be the enemy. The mainstream media will fall into line, will demonize. There's always a new Hitler coming around the corner. And the new Hitler can be religious, can be secular. But if they oppose America and if they oppose Britain, then they are ready to assume the role of the so-called new Hitler. So, you know, yes, you use the word mind-boggling. The words cannot describe the difference between what is not allowed to opponents of the regime and what is allowed once you align yourself with America. Dictatorship, extermination. Gaza is the petri dish. Gaza is a template for what is awaiting much of the rest of the world. And people know that. If anyone has any illusions of equality, if they want to say that brown-skinned people or black people are equal to white people, then trouble awaits them. This Jewish supremacist regime in Palestine, Israel, is also a white supremacist regime as well. And that is testing the ground, testing the weapons, testing the methods for dealing with future resistance to a world which could become much more like Gaza than anything else. So, yes. You say mind-boggling, I understand that perfectly, but it falls into place and makes perfect sense when you realize that there is no morality, there's only the law of the jungle, and the only thing which matters in this world to the empire is the ability to resist. And we've seen this time after. Look, we're talking about Lebanon. Israel tried to seize the south of Lebanon before. Why were they driven out? By UN resolutions? Impossible. They were driven out by the resistance of the Lebanese people led by Hezbollah and other groups.
Right.
So only resistance can possibly defend the people across the whole Middle East from this monstrous expansionist regime.
Charlotte Cates, I saw you nodding in agreement with what Mr. Napier was saying there. Talk to us about this evident hypocrisy, no condemnations from Western governments, and even the Western media sweeps it under the rug.
Well, I think it's beyond an issue of not condemning. For example, when we're talking about the United States in relationship to Lebanon, the U.S. is providing billions of dollars in weaponry on an annual basis to the Zionist regime. So when the Zionists are carrying out an assassination, a bombing, an attack on the south of Lebanon, when they're carrying out an assassination in a heavily populated area in the southern suburbs of Beirut, they're using U.S. weaponry and U.S. intelligence to carry out those attacks. So this isn't a situation where the U.S. is failing to condemn. This is a situation where the United States is jointly and severally liable for all of the war crimes being committed by the Zionist entity in Lebanon. And the same is true, you know, even if it's at a slightly smaller scale at this point, for Britain, France, Germany, Italy, and all of the imperialist states that are full partners with the Zionist regime, and are, for that matter, even carrying out a, you know, pretty severe repression against their own population in order to prevent them from taking effective action in order to impose meaningful consequences on the Zionist entity. I mean, right now, there are six of the over 30 political prisoners in British jails who are on a hunger strike against the unjust persecution of activists organizing for Palestine and British ongoing complicity and support in the genocide, not just in Palestine, but in Lebanon and throughout the region. So when we're talking about the Western countries failing to condemn, it would be condemning themselves and their own actions. They're full partners of the Zionists in these attacks, particularly when we look at the visits of U.S. officials like Tom Brock and Morgan Ortagus to Lebanon. What they're trying to do, they're trying to call it sovereignty, but they're trying to actually take away any sovereignty that Lebanon retains. They want to impose U.S. financial conditions and the U.S. sanctions list upon Lebanon's domestic economy. They want to begin house-to-house searches in targeted regions of Lebanon at the behest of the United States and the Zionist entity. They want to essentially occupy the south of Lebanon and create a so-called buffer zone that would be an industrial zone for the exploitation of labor in the south of Lebanon, with the profits going to the U.S. and the Zionist entity. This is full-on complicity, and it's an attempt to terrorize the people and government of Lebanon into accepting normalization and submission. And Hezbollah and the resistance in Lebanon, aligned with the resistance forces in the region and around the world, are the number one force that is currently protecting every bit of sovereignty that Lebanon currently has.
Mick Napier, the so-called Greater Israel map, it includes Egypt, Jordan, Lebanon, Syria, Iraq, and in some illustrations, Saudi Arabia and even Kuwait. How is this silence and lack of proper action and outrage from other Arab countries further emboldened the Israelis in this regard? Who's to say that the Israeli regime won't come for more Arab land in the future?
Well, of course they will. They always have done. They were driven out of Lebanon by resistance after trying to seize and hold everything south of the Litani. They were driven out of Sinai by the heroism of Egyptian soldiers who fought them to a standstill in 1973. It was military force which achieved that. And only resistance will protect not just the Palestinians. The Palestinians' resistance will be discussed in military staff academies for a very long time to come. They've changed the rules of asymmetric warfare. They've achieved what no one thought 2 years ago was remotely possible. But the Palestinians are being massacred in huge numbers, and Israel is changing the balance in the Middle East at the behest of the USA or in alliance with the USA. Look, this is not just Palestinians versus Israelis. Charlotte's mentioned the full spectrum collusion and participation of imperial powers. The Royal Air Force, the British Air Force, flew over Gaza 500 times during the genocide of the last 2 years, supplying intelligence to the killers on the ground below. And the minister boasted about this in Parliament. 15% of the total parts of the F-35s, which are used to carry out the genocide in Gaza, come from Britain, and without British participation, those planes could not fly. So it's not, you're right, it's not support for the genocide we're talking about. The elected rector of Glasgow University, the Palestinian, Hassan Abu Sitta, says we have to talk about an axis of genocide. I think it's a coalition of genocide. America, Britain, Brussels, and Israel, and Israel's obviously the spear point. But the genocide coalition is much, much wider than that. And I think it includes some of the Arab regimes as well. So look, in the long term, everything's working against the Israelis. The 7 million Zionist Jews surrounded by, what, 400 million, 450 million Arabs who can switch on the television and see Arabs being slaughtered because they are Arabs. This cannot persist for a very long time. But this dangerous beast, even as it faces its inevitable defeat, will cause incredible pain to the people across the Middle East. What we see in Gaza is the future that awaits people of Syria and Iraq and elsewhere, unless they follow the example of the Yemenis, of Hezbollah, and of other resistance forces across the region. They can see their doom in Gaza at the moment, and in the words of the Israelis,
okay,
that this is not the end.
And one last question for Ms. Cates. On a broader issue here, what's so evident over the course of the last 2 years is the global awareness regarding the criminal nature of the Israeli regime. But when will governments and nation states start to reflect the will of the global public?
Well, it's certainly, in many cases, we do see some states that do reflect that. We see South Africa going to the International Court of Justice. We see support from states like Nicaragua, from Venezuela, who, of course, right now are also facing extreme war threats and illegal attacks and war crimes by the United States. But it's also our responsibility in the international movement to do everything that we can to escalate the struggle, to put real, meaningful pressure on the governments in order to force them into moderating or curtailing their complicity. And we've seen some success in Spain with this. We've seen some success in Ireland. But of course, this is like a limited level of success because it's really going to be, it's not going to be the same Western governments that are responsible for the crime that are going to bring it to an end.
Okay.
It's going to be our, yeah.
All right, that's all the time we have for tonight's show. Thanks to my guests, political analyst and international coordinator Charlotte Cates, joining us from Beirut. Also, thanks to activist and commentator Mick Napier, joining us from Glasgow. And also, special thanks to you, our viewers, for staying with us on tonight's edition of Spotlight. It's good night for now, and see you next time.